This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in January.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Stokes Nature Center is participating in the National Endowment for the Arts Big Read. The book they're focusing on is You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World, edited by Ada Limon. One of the featured authors in You Are Here is poet and essayist Molly McCulley Brown. Molly McCulley Brown is the author of essay collection Places I've Taken My Body and the poetry collection The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, which won the 2016 Lexi Rudnitsky First Book Prize and was named New York Times Critics Top Book of 2017. And with Susanna Nevison, she is also the co-author of the poetry collection In the Field Between Us. She's director of creative writing at University of Wyoming and editor-in-chief of Image Journal, and she joins us in studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Exciting to have you and Logan. So we want to talk about all of those collections that I mentioned. Maybe we could start with the Big Read. This book is, of course, Poetry in the Natural World. You have a poem or two in this book.
Yeah, I've got one poem in this book. It's a really wonderful concept for an anthology. It was Ada Limon's kind of major project, or one of her major projects as Poet Laureate of the United States. And she commissioned 52 poets to write 52 poems that in some way engaged with their relationship to the natural world, to landscape. It's a really diverse array of poems. Some of them look like probably what you would expect when you think about a nature poem, poems that are just really appreciations of beauty and kind of pastoral engagements with landscape. Others are poems of grief. They're poems of the way that the natural world makes its way into urban spaces. They're poems of surprise and delight. It's a huge range, and I'm really honored to be included.
Mm. So maybe a good time, let's just jump in and have you read the poem that's in this, your poem that's in this collection.
Yeah, so this is a poem called Rabbit Brush, which I know will be a familiar word to anyone who lives around here, but was not a familiar word to me when I moved to Laramie, Wyoming a few years ago, which was a very different kind of landscape than any place that I had ever been. And so this is a poem about being in a new natural landscape, being a stranger in the natural world. And it's called Rabbit Brush. I've never seen the winter at 8,000 feet. Long stands of lodgepole pines washed white, miles of cliff face snow-capped and sheer and silvered with lichen. Slow herds of mule deer hugging the fence lines, wind-whipped and sure where they're heading. Do the aspens turn yellow before they go bare? There's a stand on the road where I've bought a small house, a red-painted door, some land. What hubris to strike out for somewhere cold enough to kill you, knowing nothing at all, not even the name of the undergrowth thatching the slope. A neighbor says, rabbit brush, and I should be afraid to be so unprepared. Herdless, human, without instinct for the West. But what comes first is wonder at the word, at having woken someplace new. I once believed I wouldn't see another winter.
Hmm. That's Rabbit Brush. Yeah. So you've been in many different landscapes. Grew up in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
right? Part of your schooling in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Now in Wyoming.
Yeah.
And you spent a year in Europe.
I did. Right? Yeah.
I guess you respond in different ways to different landscapes.
I do. Yeah. And I think what I respond to is the way that being so often in such radically different landscapes, both naturally, natural environments and built environments and cultural environments, always sort of keeps me awake to the world, right? There's a way in which sort of always changing landscapes means that you're always experiencing something new, and you're always having to kind of be attuned in the way that you are in unfamiliar places, so that you are, you know, alert for beauty and danger and finding your way around and coming to know things. And I think that, you know, for me, the kind of attunement to the world around you and the really being awake to the intricacies of where you are is one of the most important things about being a writer. And for me, having such a kind of peripatetic life has been a huge part of my relationship to what it means to do that work.
What would you suggest people who are newly into writing and maybe want to write about the landscape?
I mean, I think the first and most boring answer that any writer gives when you say, like, what recommendations do you have for folks who are newly into writing and are wanting to do it is to read, right? Nothing makes a writer like being a reader. And, you know, an anthology like You Are Here is a great place to start because it's a kind of range of poets, a range of voices, a range of making meaning on the page. And, you know, an anthology can be great because then if you read a poem by a writer that you particularly love, then you go in search of that writer's work, right? But then the other piece of it, of kind of developing a relationship to writing or a practice of writing is sort of what I talked about, which is developing a practice of kind of paying attention and looking at the world around you. I think, you know, there's a reason that the other piece of advice that writers give all the time is keep a notebook of some kind, you know, just a place to make note of the things that you notice, the things that strike you. Maybe that notebook is a literal notebook. Maybe that notebook is the voice memos file on your phone. You know, I think there are all kinds of ways to be making note of the world. But just getting in the habit of sort of, you know, maybe someone says a sentence that surprises you, or you look up and the clouds look like some kind of, you know, crazy computer cartoon, or you see a bird or an animal that you've never seen before, or you notice something about the route that the bus goes past. Just beginning to make note of those things is the foundation for beginning to be a person who writes.
How did you begin writing? So you're rural Virginia, right?
Yeah.
Your parents are writers.
They are.
Is that where it came from, or what was going on when you started writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it must be. I have two siblings who had the better sense to go do something different and more practical with their lives. My parents are fiction writers. And they like to joke that being a poet is my small rebellion, so that I'm doing something minorly different than what they do. But I think the truth is that I was a kid who just always loved to read, and was in particular always kind of struck by the music of poetry and the brevity and the compression of poetry. I have a really intense memory of pulling a copy of The Complete Works of Emily Dickinson off my parents' shelf when I was a really little kid, and reading The Soul Has Moments of Escape When Bursting All the Doors. It dances like a bomb abroad and swings upon the hours. And of course, I was maybe 8 years old and I was like, okay, I don't know what the heck that means, but I can feel the energy of it and the magic of it and the strangeness of it and the music of it, and just thinking, okay, whatever that magic trick is, I want to do that with the rest of my life. And I'm really lucky that that's how it played out.
Yeah. You're also an essayist.
I am.
So talk about what you enjoy about each, poetry and essays, and what that the difficulties of intricacies of both.
Yeah, I mean, so all of my training is as a poet, and that's, as I just sort of talked about, that's always been my kind of primary medium and genre from the time I was a very small child. And I really walked backwards, I think, into writing nonfiction, largely because the advice that I think, you know, writers are often given is if, you know, there's a book you want to read and you can't find it, you ought to write it. I should say that I have a neurological disorder called cerebral palsy, which affects my balance and my muscle function. And it means that I use a wheelchair most of the time to get around. And that was obviously a really central feature of my life and a really central feature of my adolescence in particular. And like any good nerdy kid who loves to read and always looked for her community in books, as I grew up, I went looking for narratives of life with a disability that felt like they could keep me company. And a lot of what I found were narratives of kind of illness and cure, or narratives that were about sort of like inspirational overcoming of disability. None of those narratives tracked especially closely or compellingly to my own experience, where I was a young person with a disability, and I was also, you know, interested in things in the world and falling in love with music and wanting to be outside and having crushes and worrying about the job I was going to have. And I really struggled to find narratives of an experience of disability that made room for all of those things and all of those complexities. And so I began to write personal nonfiction, partly as a way to kind of produce the kind of company that I wished that I had had as a young person. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a good way to sort of talk about the way that I see essays and poems functioning a little differently. To write a poem to me has always felt like it is kind of about the creation and the cultivation of a little world, right? The poet John Donne has this famous line in which he says, "I am a little world made cunningly." And a poem to me has always felt like a kind of little world made cunningly. And when you make it, you decide what the laws of gravity are and what color the sky is and how sound works. There's an amazing kind of magic alchemy to that act. Essays, I think, just partly by virtue of their length, they're more discursive, right? It's always felt a little more like sort of walking around in the world that exists and trying to figure things out. And that's not to say that kind of measures of both impulses don't exist in both things, right? There are so many poems that comment so beautifully and necessarily on many things about the world that we live in. And there are many essays that have sort of moments of that incredible compression and cultivation. But I often find that working in both genres gives me a kind of multiplicity of ways to try to work through complicated ideas. And sometimes I'll have an idea and I'll think it's an essay and it turns out to be a poem or vice versa. And that's one of the great sort of pleasures.
Mm. I don't want to lean on this, but I'm curious, and you've written about this, you know, you're a multifaceted person. Obviously, you know, you're living in color, right? But some people who encounter you in a wheelchair might, you know, remove the color. It's black and white to kind of put you in a box.
Sure. I mean, I think that, it's a very human and also I think a potentially really damaging impulse to, you know, see someone who has, a single facet of their identity that feels significant and maybe especially that feels different, right? And to have that be the kind of like the facet of a person's identity where the spotlight goes up, right? And that's the kind of totality of who they are. And I think, it's one of the reasons I believe in the power of creative work is that the making of art is necessarily about complicating that kind of thinking, right? I like that notion of sort of, you know, creating a universe that is in color, right? And being a person with a disability, a disabled person, is a significant part of who I am. In some ways, it touches every facet of my identity in certain kinds of ways, but it doesn't drown out or flatten any of those other kinds of identities. And I think if anything, it actually just makes me sort of attuned to them and engage with them in particularly acute ways.
You just joined us. We are talking with the poet and essayist Molly McCauley-Brown. She's in Logan, participating in the Stokes Nature Center, is participating in the NEA Big Read. And the book they've chosen is You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World. So do you have another poem from You Are Here that you'd like to read for us?
Yeah, I think that I'll read a lovely poem by the poet Ashley M. Jones, who's the poet laureate of Alabama. And it's called Lullaby for the Grieving. And I talked a little bit about the kind of range of poems in this book. And this is a poem about the ways that the natural world can be a site of grief, but also of comfort and prayer and asking. And it feels right for a moment in time in which the world is such a complicated place. Lullaby for the Grieving at the Sipsey River. Make small steps in this wild place. There are signs of life everywhere. Sharp spaces, too. The slip of a rain-glazed rock against my searching feet. Small steps, like prayers, each one a hope exhaled into the trees. Please let me enter. Please let me leave whole. There are, too, the tiny sounds of faraway birds, the safety in their promise of song, the puddle forming finally after summer rain, the golden butterfly against the cave dark. Maybe there are angels here, too. What else can I call the crown of light atop the leaves? What else can I call my footsteps forward? Small, small, sure.
Beautiful, beautiful. Tell me again the author and the title.
So the poet's name is Ashley M. Jones, and the title of the poem is Lullaby for the Grieving.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, before we go to break, I want to talk about keeping in the natural world and talk about this collaboration that you have with Susanna Nevison. It's a poetry collection called In the Field Between Us. First of all, that's an interesting project, a collaborative book.
Yeah, so the book is a collection of epistolary poems, which means that they're poems written as letters. And they're written as letters between two speakers, two people, both of whom have physical disabilities. And they're about a kind of shared experience of medical and surgical intervention, a shared experience of physical pain and a complicated relationship to the body. But they're also about, as the title kind of suggests, what it means to imagine and dream of and try to cultivate a world that feels shaped for those bodies and like it reflects those bodies. And the book is a kind of exercise in imagining, you know, what is it like to share this experience with another person and what is it like to imagine a world that is made for that experience and kind of arises out of that experience.
Mm. Do you have a poem you'd like to read from this book, In the Field Between Us?
So I'll read just from the very beginning of the book, and I think I'll read two poems, if that's okay, because they're letters back and forth.
Yeah.
And so one poem kind of answers another. And so I'll start with one of Susanna's poems, which is the first poem in the book. And again, her name is Susanna Nevison. I'll read her letter, and then I'll read the kind of answering letter in the book. Dear M, the dream where I'm legless isn't a nightmare, and I'm not afraid. There's light and a river, and everything is exactly how I'd hoped. I'm not tethered to the earth. I'm not tied down by gravity, dragging my legs along the bank gravel, not searching for the softest patch of moss. I'm not even tired, and though I'm certain the dream is an elegy, it sounds exactly like a praise song. In the dream, my legs break free of me, and I watch them float away. The coffin in my chest blows open in the wind, and for once I think I know what it's like to be without all our dead and heavy things. And this is the answering letter. Dear S, I've said this all before, and anyway, you had already been picked up, held down, put under, and refashioned. You were already dreaming your body in some gravity-less country, calling it a river, Mars. Let's go back to wherever it is we were made for first, to water or a rusted, windswept planet where everything floats and women are part horse or fox, knocked off kilter and galloping left to get where they were meant to go. We'd miss it here eventually. The boat that brought us, I believe in it. But having found you, I am seeking out the channel where we came from.
Mm, yeah, beautiful.
Thank you.
So it's M and S, and that's you and your
author, yeah,
yeah,
Molly
Susanna
and Susanna. Yeah.
Wonderful. And that's In the Field Between Us. I want to read this. This is quoting you from an interview you gave a couple years ago. You say the landscape is doing a variety of things for us. You're talking about this, the book from which you just read those two poems. One is that it's really interesting as a person with a disability to feel as if we have these bodies that are inherently wild and untamable, seem like they belong in a wilder universe than exists around us, but also to have bodies that sometimes make it quite difficult to really go out and move through the natural world. It's an interesting dichotomy.
Right? Yeah, it's sort of one of the central tensions in the book, right? What does it mean? Mean on the one hand to have a body that kind of always reminds you that you are a sort of wild and errant creature in some way, but also to sort of move, you know, more stumblingly and with more difficulty through the world. It's, you know, that is, I think, in some ways another thing that has just cultivated and sharpened my attention to the natural world, because so rarely can I move through it with any kind of fluidity. So I'm always having to pay a particular kind of acute attention. And I think that that's that kind of acute attention to landscape, to every tree root, every change in the surface, every step and bump and mound is something that Susanna shares. And I think that attention is a lot of what gave rise to the kind of imagined landscape in the collection.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting the interaction between the real landscape and imagined landscape, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this comes back to sort of my notion that, to write a poem is sort of to invent a world, right? And it's in some ways, in this book, it's kind of inventing a world that is a little bit of a kind of shadow world to the actual world, right? We're drawing from, the birds and beasts and trees and rivers that occupy the world around us, and we're kind of imagining it another side of the mirror, if it were.
Another thing you said, the one of the things you're trying to do in this book is trying to figure out where home is.
Yeah, I think, for me that has sort of two valences. And one is sort of just the sort of simple version of what we talked about, which is that I'm a person who's lived in a whole heck of a lot of different kinds of range of places and made temporary homes in a huge variety of landscapes. And so I'm always trying to think about, Where is home? Where am I rooted? But I think that also, again, living in a body that is a disabled body, that is a body that has been continually altered and re-altered by surgical and medical interventions, starting before the kind of earliest moment of my memory, is to sort of always be in search of like, what is the natural body? What is my home body? And what does it mean to not remember my body before it was changed and manipulated and altered? And so what does it mean to sort of try to be at home in a world where that is the case? And again, that's an experience that Susanna and I share. Mm-hmm. Our disabilities are very different, but they both involved a lot of early surgical intervention when we were very, very young. And that's one of the kind of animating features of the book.
Yeah. And pain is a feature here, right, as well, right? Quite consistent pain.
Yeah. And I think that a kind of relationship to physical pain means a relationship to the notion of sort of what is a natural and unnatural sensation that's really different. But again, also a relationship to time that's really different. Anybody who's spent any time in pain knows time moves really differently when you're navigating through that space. Mm. And again, also a relationship to the sort of question of like, okay, what does it mean to be? What does it mean to be good? What does it mean to be at peace? What does it mean if the natural state of your body is a state of pain? What does it mean if that pain has been caused or cultivated by intervention that is also designed to alleviate certain kinds of pain? And those complexities are really interesting, and they certainly animate the book.
Mm. I wonder, I'm thinking about Wyoming, which where you make your home now, right? Laramie, right?
Yeah.
And I'm juxtaposing that in my mind to Virginia.
Yeah.
And in my mind, Wyoming is wild and Virginia is gentle. But that's not my experience, right? My experience, why I think Wyoming is wild, I've been up there in the high plains in the summertime where they have those gates that come down in the wintertime and the snow just blows. And then I imagine that's just incredibly wild in the wintertime. Not this winter, but, But I wonder, I'm kind of placing my impressions upon you. Tell me what your true impression is.
I mean, I think, I grew up in a part of Virginia that is also very rural. And so I experience both of those places as places where the kind of wild is always in tension with the desire to sort of corral or tame it. Obviously, and I still feel I'm like 3 years into living in Wyoming now. And so I still feel very much like a kind of outsider and a new person. I'm still very much the speaker of that first poem, kind of being like, what is this wild place? To be so high, the high plains are a kind of, they're a stranger and more dramatic place than any place that I've ever lived. And I sometimes say jokingly that Wyoming never lets me forget that I'm a kind of like I'm an outside invader on the landscape, mm-hmm. and it's really trying to eradicate me, right? You know, if it's you know 10 degrees below zero and the wind is you know whipping at 35 miles an hour, you feel that it's you know you're trying to be obliterated from the landscape, mm-hmm. and so that's a very particular kind of wildness, right? But Virginia feels very much to me like it's sort of possessed of a kind of ancient wildness. You know, I'm going to say something that's, you know, maybe going to get the hackles of some Westerners up here. You know, y'all, we have these much bigger mountains out here, right? But I'm always reminding people that, you know, the reason the Blue Ridge Mountains are so much smaller than the Rockies is because they're a whole heck of a lot older, mm-hmm. right? And so I feel very much in Virginia kind of in the presence of an ancient kind of wildness and a making of the world that took place just an incredibly long time ago. And it's funny, I think that I hadn't sort of maybe identified rurality as such a common feature of a lot of the places where I've spent the most time, which again is maybe a sort of strange and unlikely thing for a person who gets around in a wheelchair and sometimes finds rurality challenging. But I think it is a really central component of a lot of the landscapes that I have loved most.
Yeah, that's a good corrective for us Westerners. Yeah, it's we get a little proud about the.
Yeah, I just feel like I got to bring everybody's right, yeah. confidence down just a little bit about that.
That's right. Yeah, we are very blessed. You know, it's 20 minutes. You can be out in the wild, right?
Totally.
That's a wonderful thing. Yeah. We're overdue for a break. Let's take a break. We're talking with poet and essayist Molly McCauley Brown. She is author of the essay collection Places I've Taken My Body and the poetry collection The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. I won a couple of awards. And we've talked about this with Susanna Nevison. She's co-author of the poetry collection The Field Between Us. More following this.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in January.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Stokes Nature Center is participating in the National Endowment for the Arts Big Read, and the book they're focusing on is You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World, edited by Ada Limone. One of the featured authors in You Are Here is poet and essayist Molly McCauley Brown, and she's in the studio with us today. So, Molly McCauley Brown, I want to turn next to your book of essays. Which you have said, reading an interview, you didn't intend this to turn into a memoir, but I guess it did.
Yeah, you know, the book came out a few years ago now, and I had sort of I was you know just approaching 30 as it was coming out, and I sort of thought, okay, unless something really extraordinary has happened to you, you maybe shouldn't write a memoir before you turn 30. And so I think I was resistant to the idea that's what I was doing, but the essays did sort of eventually come together to form a kind of catalog of my life. About half of them are set throughout childhood and adolescence, and the other half are set closer to the contemporary moment during a year that I spent on a really lucky poetry fellowship living throughout Europe. And they do form a kind of memoir and essays despite myself.
Mm-hmm. So we're about in Europe, I guess, various places.
Yeah. So several of the essays are set in Bologna, Italy, where I spent some time. There's an essay, a couple of essays set in London, they make mention of Madrid and Spain and Dublin and a whole lot of places where I was lucky enough to travel.
I don't know if there's anything, a portion of an essay or you can read or anything.
I think maybe I'll read the very beginning of an essay, which is kind of indirectly an essay about place, because it's an essay about being a person and a writer who never has any idea where they are.
Right.
And so I'll read maybe just like, what do you think, like 2 pages of that?
Yeah, that'd be fine. Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. Great. This is called If You Are Permanently Lost. I never have any idea where I am. I lived my whole childhood in the purple foothills of the same 5-square-mile town, and I still can't tell you whether you turn left or right on the single throughway to get to the grade school or the grocery store, or how to find the houses of any of my childhood friends. I can't tell you how to find the conspicuously modern angles of the apartment building in the small town in Mississippi where I lived for 3 years in graduate school, or even easily direct you from my old house in Austin to the bright little bar where I wrote much of my first book. I never know how far I am from the airport or the highway. I can't read a map effectively, and even though it's less than half a mile from my current apartment in London, I couldn't get to the Thames without the artificial voice on my cell phone, set to an Australian accent so its omnipresence is less tiresome, calling out, "Turn left," every 250 feet. Half the time, to remember which way is left, I have to imagine for an instant that I am picking up a pen. Even on a much smaller scale, space makes no sense to me. I walk all the way around the perimeter of a room to reach a door that's immediately to my right, and I set my glass down half an inch from the edge of the table with such frequency that anyone who knows me well gets used to nudging it back again and again over the course of an evening in this small, choreographed two-step. As a girl, I put my shoes on the wrong feet so reliably that my parents directed me to just behave in defiance of my inclinations. If I thought a sneaker should go on one foot, put it on the other. This is still a strategy I use sometimes. If I'm certain an office is to the right out of the elevator, I go left down the hall. I'm almost always wrong about the layout of the world. I come after a while to recognize landmarks, pale blue awning of the nearest dry cleaner, wrought iron railing along the railroad bridge, surprise of a green painted storefront among all the brick, which is how I learn eventually to navigate some frequent paths of travel. But no collection of spaces, no matter how habitually I move through them, ever knits into any kind of cogent map inside my head. I'll be wandering in the city, convinced I'm miles from anywhere I've ever been, and then turn a corner just to see the shapes of my own block rising up as if they've been transplanted, their familiarity more unsettling than encountering something new, proof I lack a homing instinct of any kind.
If you're permanently lost. Yeah, I think a lot of us can relate to that, right?
Yeah.
This disorientation, I don't know, does it feel disorienting or is that just how the world presents to you?
It often does feel disorienting. Mm-hmm. And again, my capacity to get lost in places that I know incredibly well is a kind of, it's a continual marvel. And it is always, there's a sort of low hum of anxiety that exists perpetually where you're like, okay, do I have any idea where the heck it is that I am? I think, you know, if I lived outside of the time of, GPS and a phone map that would pull things up, I think I would feel much more troubled.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also, again, I sort of spoke about this, that the essay goes on to talk about the way in which perpetual disorientation, perpetual lostness, perpetual strangeness is, as I said, it's a difficulty and it's a source of anxiety and it's a strangeness. But it's also a thing that makes the world feel continually new and surprising. Mm. And keeps you attentive to it. And it sort of ultimately does talk about the ways in which for a writer, that's a gift.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. The other thing I was thinking was, I don't know if this gets better the longer you're in a place, or are you continually just kind of disoriented?
So, I mean, sort of as I talked about in that last paragraph I read, you know, a thing that does start to happen is that I do recognize landmarks, right? Mm-hmm. Like things are familiar to me and, you know, I learn street names and I learn like, okay, you know, you always turn left at Spring Creek. And so in that way, it gets better in that I sort of develop a compensation mechanism for familiar places. But I never you could ask me about the hometown where I lived for sort of all of my conscious childhood. And you could say like, okay, you know, on the major throughway, is the grocery store to the left or the right? And I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Right. Yeah. As you say, a gift to you as a writer. I was thinking if it does get better, you subvert that by continually moving, right?
So. Yeah. Well, yeah. The essay talks about that too.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's a particularly strange choice for a person who both sort of has some challenges with moving physically through the world and also is a perpetually lost person to be like, oh, I think I'm just going to up and up and make this new again every few years. And it is a strange choice. And I think there are things about that that are maybe about certain kinds of avoidance, right? And if I'm always new to a place, then it's not that weird that I don't know my way around.
Yeah.
But I also think that there are things that are about just leaning into being engaged in that continual state of exploration, right? And wanting to feel like I've seen as much of the world, again, both wild and natural and built and urban as I possibly can.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to find this. Yes, you gave an interview talking about this essay collection, and it's difficulty navigating, but also the physical difficulties, the cobblestones of Bologna, right?
Yeah.
Not so easy on a wheelchair. But you say I figured out how to have the experience of my body in a space that didn't just feel like it was 100 shut doors.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there were and are a lot of shut doors that happen because there are cobblestones or there's a staircase or there's, a hallway that I can't fit through in the wheelchair. And that was that's an experience that happens to me all over the world, both in the places that are familiar to me and in brand new places. It's an experience that was particularly acute the year that I lived in Europe, partly because I was traveling so much and then partly because so many of those cities are so wonderfully ancient, right? And it's a real complexity that often the places that are sort of the oldest and whose history I most want to be able to enter are some of the places that are hardest to get around. But again, I think that learning to think about the way that that experience requires attention and adaptation a kind of willingness to, you know, sometimes physically work around things and then also sometimes just pivot in my expectation of what I'm going to do or where I'm going to be, learning to think about that as a tool and a resource in addition to a challenge was really important for me. Not as a way of saying, oh, this isn't painful anymore or it isn't complicated or I don't wish it were otherwise or I don't believe that we should continually and always be working toward a more accessible world in a lot of senses, but as a way of saying like, okay, this gives me a particular lens on the world. It allows me to talk about things and be aware of things in a particular way. And it gives me an experience of otherness and difficulty that I hope makes me a more compassionate and justice-oriented and aware person in a kind of broad cross-section of ways.
Hmm. I want to talk about exterior life and how to translate into the interior life. I wanted to go more into the interior life. And you as teacher, right? You were a student before, now teacher. You're at University of Wyoming teaching creative writing. So you're teaching them to write, but they need to read as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you give them a list of books or just whatever they bring in or what?
Yeah, I mean, there's a syllabus for every class, mm-hmm. right, which is, a selection of texts that feel like they're core to the learning of students in that class for whatever reason. And I'm always trying as a teacher to kind of create a syllabus and a reading list, which is sort of ranging, right, and going to give students of sort of as broad a variety of kinds of entry points as possible. I think, one of the things that I try to do as a teacher is teach students, especially at the undergraduate level, the pleasure and value of reading. But then also to help all of my students, regardless of whether they're graduate students or undergraduate students, or whether they, are naturally inclined toward reading or not, think about the value of kind of reading beyond your immediate taste and enjoyment, right? And thinking about like, okay, maybe this isn't sort of appealing or even comprehensible to me in the very beginning, but how if I take it on its own terms and if I pay attention to it, does it grow into something that offers me something? Both because I think that is part of how you train better writers, right? But also because I think that's part of how you train more empathetic citizens, right? People who see the value of lives and experiences that might overlap with their own in certain kinds of ways and might look nothing like their own. And I think I think about my job as a teacher. Yes, that I'm trying to train better writers and more creative and flexible thinkers. But I'm also just trying to train people who are more attentive to the world and have a more expansive notion of what a valuable life looks like.
Mm-hmm. Do you have students come in? I encounter people who kind of have a block about poetry. That I think one of the things is fear. They're not going to understand it.
100%. Yeah, I think there's, especially with undergrads, there's often a sense of like, okay, I know how to read a paragraph, right? That's a thing I experience all the time. But why are these lines broken in this way? What is a stanza? What is this other way of making meaning that's maybe not quite so narrative? And I think I'm always trying as a teacher both to put poems in front of them that are going to feel you know, more immediately welcoming or engaging, but also to teach them that, like, the things they know about doing other kinds of reading and even just the things they know about sort of, like, being a person who moves through the world and communicates with other people are applicable to poetry, right? That thinking about an image is actually something they do all the time in their own lives, and thinking about, you know, the way we make choices in terms of word order or lineation or even the existence of a metaphor, right? As much as that might be new terminology for them, we make our lives in metaphors, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a huge part of sort of how I think about my role.
Yeah. You talked about 8 years old encountering Emily Dickinson, didn't mm-hmm. totally understand it, but excited by the language, right? And that mm-hmm. you knew there was something special there. Mm-hmm. What excites you these days? Name a couple of writers who you're really into at this point.
Oh gosh, I mean, all the same things excite me as used to. There's a poet, his name is Gabrielle Cavalcaresi, whose most recent book, The New Economy, was just shortlisted for the National Book Award. And that book is a book about both the grief and the joy of being alive. And it's, I feel like I have, I read it and then have immediately given it to like every human being who I can possibly convince to take it. It's such an exciting and really wonderful and important book. There's a new book by a poet, his name is Cam Awkward Rich, which is really, really lovely and beautiful. But the truth is I could just do this and name poets forever. Mm-hmm. I think, again, if I'm training my students to be active readers, then that feels like the kind of most central obligation of my life as a writer and a teacher, too.
Well, let's go to another break, and we'll be back with our last segment with Molly McCauley-Brown, who's an author, essayist, and poet. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in January.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with poet and essayist Molly McCauley-Brown. You can find her at mollymccauleybrown.com, I think it is, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And she's in studio with us, so thank you. And Molly McCauley-Brown is author as well of the essay collection Places I've Taken My Body. Also with Susanna Nevison, the co-author of the poetry collection In the Field Between Us. I want to turn to the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Won several prizes with this, the book. So how did this come about, this collection?
So the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded was the name of a real residential hospital that in the early and mid-1900s in rural Virginia was one of the major hubs of the American eugenics movement. And so what this means is that thousands of people who either had or were perceived to have a variety of physical and intellectual disabilities were forcibly committed and forcibly sterilized there, not only without their consent, but often without their knowledge. They were told that they were being given an appendectomy and were sterilized instead. I grew up just a few miles from the grounds of this facility, which remained an operational residential facility for adults and children with serious disabilities until its closure in April of 2020. The book arose out of my coming to understand more about the history of this place and also coming to confront how much I didn't know about this history and about eugenics in America in particular, its relationship to disability, and confronting the fact that if I had been born in the part of the world that I lived in and loved, even 50 years earlier, I would have been a prime candidate to be a colony patient. And the book is set largely in the voices of imagined patients and staff in the 1930s at the height of the sterilization movement.
Mm. So this was the cast a pretty wide net. Anybody who was, I guess, disabled or considered feeble-minded, or what?
Yeah, I mean, there were a huge range of people who were institutionalized and sterilized in the eugenics movement. This happened obviously to people of color, right? It happened to people who had a variety of physical and intellectual disabilities, and it also happened to people who were just deeply impoverished, right? Who were perceived to have a variety of intellectual and sometimes physical disabilities. Virginia State Colony was a facility for white Appalachians, but there were other facilities for Black Americans where this was also happening at a wide level. So yeah, a wide range of people who were in any way considered undesirable, right, or like they might threaten the kind of future of the country in some way.
So in your collection of essays, you're treating real people, but also people you imagine. Be the voices of people you imagine be there as well. Can you read something from the collection?
Yeah, so this is the poetry collection, as I said, is called The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, and it's set in the 30s at the height of the sterilization movement, and it's divided into rooms. So each section of the book is poems in a different room. And so I'll read a poem that's from the dormitory section, it's called Labor. If you have the body for it, you're bound for the fields to pick strawberries and coax the milk from cows, or hired out to make baking powder biscuits and gravy, to sweep floors and wash and fold a stranger's clothes. You come back on a truck after sunset, raw and ragged, covered in flour, tobacco, or clay. You come back bone-tired and bruised, burned dead out and ready to be shut away. You sleep. I know all this from stories. I do not have the body for it. I do not go to the fields or the barns or the parlors of other folks' houses. I wake at sunrise when they wake the rest, lie in bed till somebody hauls me out and puts me by the window. Lord, I know. To want to work's a foolish thing to those who've got a body built for working. I was as close to born here as you can get. Brought twisted and mewling to the gates and left. Since then, I am one long echo of somebody else's life. Every understanding that I have is scrap, is shard, is secondhand. Distance, the space between the porch railing and the rise of the Blue Ridge. Water, what comes from a bucket to my body on Sundays, what I open my mouth for morning and night.
Yeah. Powerful. Yeah. It's quite a thing to try to come to terms with that, right? It's poetry is a very appropriate medium.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that art can do and that poetry is particularly well suited to do is kind of imagine into the gaps and silences and erasures that pervade the historical record, right? It's one of the sort of complications of public history that the official archive and the official record and the official story is almost always told by people in power, right? People who were empowered. And art can... using what I call the kind of informed imagination, right? So the combination of research and dreaming, or what the writer and critic Sadia Hartman would call critical fabulation, can invent into the spaces where people's stories haven't been, they haven't been kept, they haven't been told, and they haven't been valued. And this is one of the things that the book is trying to do, not stand in for the actual lived experience of women who were colony inmates and colony patients, but draw attention to the silences and the violence that happen when we erase those stories from the record.
Well, we're out of time. Much more we could say on that, I'm sure. But thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.